Okay, good morning. Thank you. Yes, my name is Chris Brown. I am a senior lecturer at the UCL Institute of Education. And for the last 5 years, really, I've kind of been working on evidence to practice. And my presentation is about new tools for an old problem. And it's called that because this notion of connecting research to practice is an old problem. It's something that's been going along since at least the 1970s. And it's still one that we probably haven't effectively cracked yet, still one that we're still working on. But what I'm hoping to present today is some new thinking, some additional ideas, some ways of conceiving and going back to your comment about handability and appropriation. What are we talking about in terms of connecting research and practice? What do we mean by things like fidelity? What does that account to? So, in terms of me, I began life very much interested in evidence-informed policy. I was very much interested in, I did my PhD on why policymakers, why people in the Department for Education in England or elsewhere would take on board evidence and make better education policy. But it kind of slowly dawned on me that I was kind of beating my head against a wall with this, in the sense that, policy is very much driven by ideology. And, in many cases, since the recent kind of conservative and before that, the Liberal Democrat conservative coalition, that there was more ideological driven policymaking than there was kind of evidence informed policymaking. So I started to broaden out to look at the connection between research and practice, and then exclusively to think about research and practice and how we need to engage teachers with research and how we might do that. So my kind of current work areas of focus really are about three things. The first is about educational leadership in schools. If we've got relatively kind of autonomous school systems where school leaders are able to decide how they want to improve their schools or groups of schools, what decisions are open to them and how might they select from those, and how might research play a part in that? Likewise, if a school leader wants to embark on having a research engaged school, what do they need to do? What's required from school leaders to make that happen? What are the kind of cultural and structural factors that they need to think about to make that happen? And then third, and what I'm going to concentrate on today, is how we might get educational practitioners to engage effectively with research and what we might want to do to make that happen. And I think it's important to kind of define what I mean by evidence-informed practice and what I'm talking about here. And to do that, I'm taking my definition from the Department for Education, and in particular this notion of combination, because what the Department of Education say, or what they said at least in 2014, was that evidence-informed practice is not, the kind of passing down of strategies and saying, okay, schools, act on these, or not the passing down of evidence and saying, okay, this is exactly what you need to do to, say, improve feedback or, the teaching of English as an additional language. But it's about how we might take what teachers know already, their kind of practical teacher knowledge, and how we might combine that with the research knowledge that exists in order to produce new and effective ways of teaching and learning. So that's more or less what I'm about. So going back to your point about handability or appropriation, I'm about taking research and about how we might adapt it to context and how we might use it in context. Now, why might we do this? Well, there are a number of benefits to schools using evidence. To be fair, this is a kind of still new emerging area. There's not much research on research use. There's not much research to say, if you do this, there are given definable benefits. But there is some, and we've got people like John Sopovich saying that actually, if we look at the highest performing school systems in PISA, then a common characteristic is that these school systems are using research in two ways. First of all, to understand what problems they might be facing and to identify the root causes of those problems, but also then to understand how those problems might be addressed and how we might engage in new solutions. We've also got colleagues such as Monica Minku, Philip Accordingly, looking at correlations or reporting correlations and saying, actually, we can start to see, again, this is not definitive cause and effect, but we can start to see that where research and data are used as part of high quality teacher, initial teacher education, so you know, training teachers to be teachers, part of ongoing professional development, part of headship training, we can start to see a very positive difference in terms of teacher, school, and system performance. So we're starting to see that relationship come through. What's more, we've got other colleagues, so people like David Godfrey, Graham Hanscom, Toby Greeney, suggesting that actually, when we look at research-engaged schools, so those schools that take a very strategic, concerted approach to using research, they start to move away from what we call a top tips model of working and a very superficial sharing of advice to one in which you get a more realistic understanding of what seems to work for whom and in what situations. But evidence-informed policy itself is situated within a broader context, and certainly within England, you've got what's called the self-improving school system. And you know, this isn't just common to England, but it's certainly very big in England at the moment. And here we're talking about schools becoming more autonomous, where they're required to kind of seek out and share new evidence as a way of getting better. And so schools are encouraged to do this, but they're also almost forced to do this in the sense that you've got increased accountability, you've got increased parental choice, you've got competition, but you've also got a reduction in kind of top-down mandates in terms of teaching strategies, which are kind of therefore pushing schools to be in this situation of self-improvement. And kind of looking at what this notion of self-improvement means, Toby Greeney suggests there are four key characteristics. So you've got, first of all, teachers in schools are responsible now for getting better themselves, for continuously improving their outcomes for children. You've got this notion of teachers in schools learning from each other and from research so that they identify and spread best practice. This idea that schools, the most effective schools, need to extend their reach so that all schools start to improve. And like I said before, that this kind of notion of any other forms of support, you know, teaching strategies, sorry, literacy strategies, numeracy strategies, and so on, are kind of continuously minimized and rolled back. And indeed, some schools, teaching schools in England, have a specific mandate to engage with research. They're expected to build on existing research as it relates to their priorities. They are supposed to develop new initiatives on existing research. They're supposed to measure the impact of these initiatives. They are supposed to make sure that new staff can use existing evidence, but also that they're supported to do so, so that the structures and the cultures are in place for them to engage with research evidence. So my kind of new tool for the old problem is this notion of research learning communities, and that's what I'm going to kind of focus on now. The history really of research learning communities comes from 2014, where in England we have the Evidence Endowment Foundation, and the role of the Evidence Endowment Foundation is a what's work centre. So basically it pulls together evidence on what appears to be effective in teaching and learning. And they have the What Works Toolkit, which is a free-to-use resource. It's, you know, it's an interesting resource. It's very comprehensive. It sets out for, like Hattie's work, it sets out given interventions and the effect sizes those interventions might have if teachers use them in the classroom. So it's based on meta-analyses, meta-syntheses. Now, I'm not going to go into a problematization of that toolkit here, but it's, you know, plenty of people have done it, and I'm sympathetic to those views. Nonetheless, the EEF, they said, okay, well, we've produced this toolkit, and we've got this great toolkit, and it tells teachers exactly what they need to do if they want to improve teaching and learning in their classrooms. So why is nobody using our toolkit? And that was their problem. Nobody seems to be using the toolkit. So they put out a call to say, we want to increase the use of our toolkit, more or less, but they kind of couched it in, we want to increase the use of research and evidence in schools. And they asked for a call. So I pulled together colleagues from the Department for Learning and Leadership in the Institute of Education, who have all, you know, more or less got an interest in this area. And we looked at what we had done. We looked at the past work we'd engaged in. So I'd worked extensively with Professor Louise Stoll on professional learning communities. We'd had grants from, you know, research councils to work with middle leaders, teachers leaders, so to look at how we might use them as catalysts for evidence-informed change. I've been doing some research-centered lesson study work with schools in one part of London called Camden, and in early years centers, so with children from 0 to 4. So we'd done a lot of work, and we kind of pulled together what we knew, or what we thought we knew, was effective in connecting research to practice. And the first thing was this idea of a notion of a cycle of inquiry. So research use isn't a one-off hit. You don't go, here you go, here's some research, go off and use it. It's about a continuous process of improvement. So one way you start, and you set your vision. You say, okay, where do we want to be in a year's time, in 6 months' time, if we take a particular subject, if we take improving feedback to students? Where do we want to get to? What does that look like for our students? How will they be behaving differently? How will they be feeling? How will they be saying? How will they be responding if we get to this vision? And then pulling that back and saying, okay, if that's the vision, what's the current reality? Where are we now? And what does that gap look like between where we are now and where we're trying to get to? And it's then you start to engage with the research and say, okay, how might the research help us develop new approaches to close this gap between where we are now and where we want to get to? Then you start to embed that strategy, that research-informed approach. You evaluate success, you keep measuring whether it is making a difference. And for that, you need a theory of action. You need to be able to understand why you think this approach is going to make a difference and how that's going to impact on knowledge, behaviors, learning, and so on. You evaluate that, you keep measuring it, and you adjust, and you go around. So the first thing is to make sure that it's part of a bigger process. It's part of a new way of thinking how we might get better as a school. The second is this notion of expertise. I'm very keen that this process is about making teachers better teachers, but making them more effective experts as teachers. And so for this, I drew on the Dreyfus model. And this is used by Bent Flyvberg, and he talks about it in Making Social Science Matter Again. But this kind of notion of Dreyfus suggests that when we start with anything, we begin life as a novice. So if we think about learning to drive a car, you know, before we even sit in the car, we can learn very context-independent rules for action. We can learn how we need to change gears. We can learn about the need to look in the mirror and then indicate and then pull out. We can look at, you know, braking distances, road speed limits, and so on and so forth. But it's only when we start to apply these things in real-life situations that we start to develop expertise, because we start to learn how to respond in different contexts and different ways, so that we give meaning then to the kind of context independenceness by providing context. So suddenly you start to drive in different weather conditions on different types of roads and so on. But when you get to expert, you kind of go a bit beyond that. You have a very intuitive, holistic understanding of how to respond. You kind of instantly know what you're supposed to be doing. And that's what we wanted to achieve with our teachers. To give you another example, this is a 12-stage guide to hand washing. There's lots of hospitals in England that have this 12-stage guide to hand washing. I expect you have it too. But I'm not going to embarrass you by asking who uses all 12 stages to wash your hands, right? This is a kind of, you know, a platonic ideal for hand washing. We kind of, you know, if we want to teach our children about washing hands, we'd probably, you know, encourage them to do these things. But over time, we understand when it's important to use aspects of this and when not. So for sure, if we've got someone who's going to do an operation, a doctor who's going to do an operation on us, yeah, we hope that they've used all 12 steps. If we've been in the garden and it's dinner time, we might not use all 12 steps. So we kind of know what the situation requires of us because we've experienced, you know, hand washing over time. Tim will know who this is. This is Kevin, well, I hope people know who it is. It's Kevin Keegan, football player, England football player. He used to play for my team, Southampton. Anyway, this is in the 1970s. This is Kevin Keegan teaching children how to cross the road, you know, how to be safe in crossing the road, okay? So does anybody know what, it would be different in France, and that's absolutely fine. Does anybody know how many stages there are to crossing the road? What the official road crossing guide is? Okay. It is a platonic way, yeah, but it, you know, it's a pretty defined way of, that's the next green cross code man. It's a different message. I'll come back to that in a second. So according to the green cross code, there are 5 stages to crossing the road. So you have to think first, you have to stop, you have to use your eyes and ears, you have to wait till it's safe to cross, you have to look and listen again. There is a 6th stage, it says arrive alive, but I don't count that as a stage because that's a kind of guide for life generally, I think. I had a German colleague with me this week over, and she was kind of crying out that I was some kind of anarchist because I would just cross the road, because in London that's what you do, you just cross the road. In Germany, as I've come to realize, you know, you wait for the signals. You don't just cross the road. There's very strict rules. And certainly in Berlin in December, I had a police car reverse up the road to tell me that I was crossing the road in the wrong way, which is, I was amazed because, you know, I've got my expertise. I know how to cross the road. Just going back to Dave Prowse, my main message here, which I'll come on to later, is it's who's telling you the message. I would trust Kevin Keegan because, you know, I respect him because he's a football player. This guy was the Green Cross Code man and came back for a stint, and I'm probably less inspired by his message. I think, Tim, actually, this actor played Darth Vader, is that right? Which is even more, you know, worrying, I think. However, just on this, do you have hedgehogs in France? I assume you do. Yeah, most of the time you see them squashed by the side of the road, I believe. So actually, are they the best medium to tell you how to cross the road? Probably not. But that's another story. So my point being, we wanted teachers to engage with research, to get them to a stage where they were experts, where they weren't following 6 stages to engaging in effective feedback or behavioral policy or whatever else. They knew how to do it kind of instantly and effectively. Now, the next thing we wanted to look at was this notion of professional learning communities, because actually this is a great way of bringing people together to get them to collaborate, to get them to learn about new processes, to share effective practice. This is from Louise Stoll's work from 2006, but she talks about these kind of key characteristics of professional learning communities. So they have a shared vision and purpose. They're trying to go for the same goal. They have consistent and collective responsibility for student learning. Student learning is the responsibility of all people in the room. It's about deep and meaningful collaboration. It's not about that kind of top tips culture. It's about learning for the school and the individual. And it's about teachers developing an inquiry habit of mind, about them wanting to continuously investigate. Now, as an aside, I mean, one of the things we want from our children is for them to develop as 21st century knowledge workers. And in fact, they can only do that if teachers model those behaviors to them. So actually, this inquiry habit of mind of teachers investigating and continuously seeking to improving also has benefits of being able to try and transmit that way of working to children. 2 other things, though. A culture of entrust is absolutely vital. One of the ways of working, that's promoted in professional learning communities and also research learning communities is that you are opening yourself up. You're exposing exposing yourself in terms of saying, okay, this is my current level of understanding and practice, and I want to get better. And it's important that you trust your colleagues so that you're engaging in a process of mutual support and development. And that's, that takes some time to do. The other important thing is this notion of diverse perspectives. We don't want groupthink. We want people to come in and present new ideas and say, actually, I think maybe if you try something different, this is how we can improve. Now, what's interesting about professional learning communities is that there's evidence to show that they have benefits for teacher practice and student outcomes. And that's kind of well documented. But one of the reasons why that happens is this notion of learning conversations. Now, this is Nanaka and Takuchi's model of the learning conversation. It was taken from their work looking at the Japanese economy in the kind of mid to late 80s, where the Japanese economy was taking over the world, and people wanted to know why. And actually, Nanaka and Takuchi looked at it and they said, well, these things happen in Japanese firms. And the first thing is this idea of externalization. If you think about a classroom, a staff room, which is the room that all staff go to have a cigarette and whatever else. In a school, teachers have hundreds of years of experience in a big school, possibly even 1,000 if you've got a really big school. Lots and lots of experience. So before we even need to go to the research, we need to say, what is the experience and knowledge we have together? And let's talk about that. And that's important generally for scaffolding, because you may have a very experienced school leader talking to a newly qualified teacher, and the head teacher will assume that the newly qualified teacher has the same level of knowledge, and they'll make those assumptions, and they'll talk about concepts and ideas maybe without fully explaining them, which means we're not picking up on that full breadth of knowledge that exists. So the first thing we need to do is to kind of make our tacit knowledge explicit and say, okay, let's get everything on the table we know about effective practice. The next thing then is to start to combine, so we can look at research on a given issue. And I use feedback a lot because a lot of the schools I work with are engaging in feedback. But we can say, okay, well, this is what we know as a school. This is our, hundreds and thousands of years worth of experience on what's great about feedback and effective feedback. Let's look at some research as well. And how does that augment what we know? How does it challenge what we know? How does it enable us to go further in terms of what we do? Then we move to this notion of internalization. And internalization is where you start to make explicit knowledge tacit again. Okay, and the way you do that, basically, is by trialing something and practicing. So if you think about what I said about learning to wash your hands, driving a car, crossing the road, what you have done is you've taken those kind of rules of action and you've practiced and practiced and practiced. And then suddenly, because you've practiced in many different situations in response to a number of different pupils or classes or whatever else, you've started to internalize that knowledge and put it back in your head. So you know how to respond intuitively and holistically to a given situation. And then finally, socialization is that when you're having these tacit-to-tacit knowledge conversations in the staff room, by that time, you've got a common grounding of tacit knowledge. But what's more, you are then able to start the cycle again and build on and improve that knowledge. So the kind of argument I guess I'm making here is that if we want to develop expertise, we need to engage in learning conversations that within professional learning communities, because it is this process that delivers the expertise I've been talking about and that we're seeking to achieve. Okay, so network learning communities are like learning communities, but they operate across schools. Now, there are 26,000 schools in England. If we want to achieve research use, evidence-informed practice at scale, we can't just focus within schools. We have to bring schools together. And so this is the notion then that instead of having just a learning community within a school, you take people out of a school, you bring them together, you work with them, you send them back into the school to kind of disseminate or work with other teachers to promote their knowledge. So that was important for us. We wanted to engage with a lot of schools. The other thing we wanted to think about was who to have in the room. Who are we going to bring together as part of these learning communities to engage with research? Now, this is a traditional hierarchical model of school leadership. And you have your head teacher, your school leader at the top. You have your deputies or your assistants, your heads of department, and so on and so forth, all the way down to teacher level. And that's an important concept in terms of the transformational leadership piece. So we need someone to set a vision for the school. We need someone to say, this is where we want to go. This is the way things are going to be around here. And that's important for that. It's also important for setting, for resource allocation, for setting cultures and structures, and saying, okay, I want to provide time for people to work together and so on and so forth. It's also important in many ways for the learning-centered leadership piece as well. So having someone who can model what good teaching and learning looks like, who can actually work with teachers to say this is the way what I want things done. But if we think about social capital, if we think about the kind of social aspects of engaging with others, so the flows of trust, the flows of support and advice, the flows of friendship, then that's not always the way things work in a school. And in fact, often you'll get different chains of social capital, of influence, that are informal. So if you think about within a classroom, there's likely to be people who aren't hierarchically placed, but can influence people within a classroom, within a school setting. They're the people whose opinion and advice matter. They're the people who've been there 30 years and people go to because they want to understand how to engage in a certain aspect of teaching and learning. So as well as the people at the top, we need the people who are able to connect to others, the people who are able to both draw on the knowledge of others, but also push out support and advice and new ways of thinking to others. So these are what we call the opinion formers. Okay, so they're the people who've got a lot of social capital. They're able to reach out to others, but they're also able to push out to others as well. So, research learning communities are network learning communities. They focus on engaging in research, or with research rather, to tackle issues of teaching and learning. They operate in cycles of inquiry. They're about capacity building. They're about providing both intra and inter-school support for school development. For our project, the one that was funded by the Education Endowment Foundation, we recruited 110 primary schools in England. We worked with 55 of those. The other 55 formed a control group because it had to be a randomized control trial. That was the condition of the funding. Those 55 schools were split into 10 communities. Within each school, we drew a senior leader, but we also identified opinion formers, and we used social network analysis to be able to do that. So with social network analysis, what we did was we took the name of every person in the school, and we asked them, who do you turn to for advice and support? How often do you turn to these people? What is the quality of the advice and support? Who do you consider a friend? Who do you express your frustrations to? And we developed a map of those people that were kind of highly sought out by others, that were really kind of powerful in a kind of informal sort of way. The 10 research learning communities that we developed meet four times a year for whole day workshops that facilitated myself, and I had a team of 6 people to do this. And what we would do is we'd take them through this approach. So in the first workshop, we would be about understanding a given topic. So, you know, all the schools might be interested in feedback, for example. So we'd say, okay, we'd go through that process of kind of explication. You know, what is it we know about this? What does the research say about this? Where are we currently? Thinking about that cycle of inquiry, where are we currently? Where do we want to get to? And then we'd ask them to collect some initial baseline data just to make sure that the problem they thought they had was the problem that they really did have. In between times, the teachers would go back and they would share. They had homework tasks, so they would go back and they would share with colleagues. They'd come back and then they would start to develop a new intervention to, say, improving feedback. And in between sessions, they would go and they'd trial. We'd introduce them to things like lesson study or joint practice development. And they would go back and they would trial with their colleagues. And then they'd keep measuring the impact of that. And they'd come back and they'd refine it with us. And we'd say, okay, how well is this doing for you? Do you need to change it? We'd start in workshop 3, we'd introduce them to whole school change and theories of change and how to deal with adopter types and how to deal with people at different stages of their career and what needs to be in place if you want to facilitate change within a school, because this is a big job. It's almost countercultural to start introducing new ways of working into school. So you need to engage with how to effectively change it. They'd go back and they'd start to embed their new approach more widely within the school. And then in workshop 4, we would take stock and we would share impact with others. As I've said, the it was important that each of these learning communities agree in advance on the topic they want to look at, because that's how it works. Because then you've got when you're explicating, when you're saying what do we know, you can not only draw on your advice and knowledge, your knowledge of your school, but also of the other schools around you. They didn't necessarily have to develop the same intervention, but it had to be the same topic area. And what we'd also do is we thought very carefully about the materials we used, about the ways we engaged people with the research, and I'll talk about some of those in a second. In the second year, we were trying to capacity build, because it was a two-year project, and in year three, we want schools to run with this without us being there. So when the funding finished, we want schools to kind of be able to continue on with this. And so it's about capacity building. So, you know, we have two experienced champions, evidence champions in the school. They've been through this process. They know what to do. And we've provided, you know, toolkits and help and support to kind of go on with this. But the kind of process changes. So in the morning, in year two, the members of the community themselves are running part of what they're doing. They've gone off in the summer term and they've done a literature review and they've sharing that now. And we're capacity building by helping teachers engage with new forms of research, you know, using children as researchers, or understanding better about how they might engage in joint practice development and so on. So we would slightly structure year two differently. Okay, so some of the tools we used, I think these are quite innovative, quite exciting actually. So the knowledge mobilization we engaged in, well, okay, what do we mean by knowledge mobilization? I mean, there are plenty of examples. We've got a very lengthy one by Sharples about evidence being produced, transformed. We collaborate on in terms of its use. How is it mediated within schools? How does it better improve teaching practice and so on? What I'm talking about is how we made sure that research was used and combined within these sessions. And actually, we used a lot of different approaches, and I'll talk about these ones kind of individually, but you know, this here is how we presented our research literature to our teachers. Over in the corner, you know, we've got Lego, jelly beans, sticks, whatever. This is how we got them to think about what was going on in their school and how they might start to change the current situation. We used posters, we used jigsaw learning. So it was a lot of different activity that we'd engage in every workshop. So the first of those, this notion of props and model making, I mean, this wasn't just me trying to have some fun with some teachers. I mean, this is based on this idea that it's about negotiation, and it's about using a kind of separate medium to both overcome kind of power differential. So if you've got a school leader and an opinion former, and the opinion former is a year one teacher, you want that opinion former to be able to have a meaningful say in what's going on. And the use of props and models can help with that. Not only that, it also means when you are explaining a story, the story becomes invested in the model you make. So when you're sharing your story with other people, when you take that back into the school, you can have your model, and the story is there, it's invested, you've given the prop, you know, life, and the story remains in that prop, and you can use it to share. But it also means you've got a very tactile tool which you can then manipulate to make sure that people's understanding, their interpretation is used. So if you've developed a model and saying, this is my classroom, this is how I see it working, and someone else can say, well, when I come and visit you and I look at it, actually, I tend to see this, and they can move it around, and you start to develop kind of mutual and common understanding that's invested in that prop. So this is a kind of slightly bigger, a bigger picture. I mean, I hope really that they're not skewering their pupils with sticks, but I think it's basically the flows of information that they're talking about in their classroom, and which children are talking to each other, and the colours of the suites are higher ability and lower ability children, as I understand it. So that's what's kind of going on in their school, and then they're trying to work out how to make that different. So it's great for a number of things. It's great for kind of combination, but we used it mainly for this notion of externalization. What's going on in our school? What do we know about effective practice? Now, as I said before, one of the things we wanted to do was to say to teachers, okay, how does the research kind of add to what you're doing, your understanding as a kind of class? And some of the dangers of giving teachers kind of literature reviews, or giving anybody literature reviews, not just teachers, is that you take from it what you want. You skip over the stuff that you don't want to engage with, and you agree with, you know, you take out the stuff that you agree with. Now, there are plenty of ways to overcome that and to achieve kind of cognitive dissonance and whatever. Stephen Katz and Lisa Ann Dack suggest that you could take two colored pens and you could read through a literature review and you could highlight with one pen what you agree with and the other pen what you disagree with, so that you start to think. What we did was we developed literature reviews on each of the topics and we cut them up into little strips and we asked the teachers to read each strip and to give it a theme with a post-it note and to start allocating all those strips to different themes. So they made sense of the research themselves. We were just telling them, you know, the facts, let's say, that came from the literature. They were actually making sense of that themselves. They were giving it themes, so it became personal to them. After that, we could then get them to allocate those themes to what they'd already told us they knew in terms of effective teaching and learning. So we could say, okay, what does this, you know, what does this particular theme say, and how does it connect? How does it challenge what you already know? So they would start to kind of bring that together. Just a quick word on kind of research quality. The notion of research quality is complex, difficult. So I didn't want to get into too much detail about it, but at the same time, you know, these are teachers that exist in a high accountability environment. So what we wanted to do was to kind of give them evidence that they could defendably engage with if the school inspectorate came around. So we use kind of Hattie's work. This is the teaching and learning toolkit I talked to you about. But at the same time, we also kind of we wanted to introduce to them the notions of kind of what effective qualitative and quantitative research was, being able to engage with both, but understanding the kind of warrants of truth you can get from each. Making sure that they could interrogate in terms of producer interests and cognitive biases, but also the notion of cargo cult science. And this kind of notion of cargo cult science comes from just after the Second World War. You had American air bases in the Pacific, and the people who lived on these islands would see what the American air forces were doing, and they could see these certain things happening, and they could see planes coming down and delivering supplies and flying back off again. And then when the Americans left, the plane stopped, so the people kind of replicated what they could see, and they built bamboo control towers, and they kind of put, you know, pretend headphones on, and they'd wave their arms like this, because they thought those are the actions that were going to deliver success. So we're trying to say to them, what's a theory of change? What is going to deliver change, and how can you get that from the research? Effective brokerage, very important. You've got people like Rogers, Hubers, saying, okay, well, when you're going back to your school, when you're taking these messages back, there are kind of differences in the effectiveness of how you might do that. So you might use, you know, face-to-face communication. You might use a boundary object, so a manual or a report and hand that back. But actually the best way of communicating back what you're learning is conducting similar learning community activity within your school. So we try to encourage them to do that where possible, but also to make sure that this kind of the way they were communicating was beyond just awareness, just, you know, how to do something new, but also actually shared those underlying principles with teachers themselves. And we also wanted to kind of help them with the ambient, I guess, kind of knowledge mobilization. So we introduced them to kind of processes of toolkits and so on. Making sure that participants play their parts. So, making sure that people knew why they were in the room, what the role of the leader was when they went back into the school, what the role of the opinion former was when they went back into the school. And as I said before, this notion of, you know, kind of internalization, making sure that they're engaged in, you know, lesson study or other activity. Okay, measuring success. Interestingly, you know, there are lots of different ways this project is being measured in terms of success. The first is that we've got a randomized control trial. Now, that's been conducted by a different university. The findings will be out in May time. The problem I have with this randomized control trial is that when I applied for the project, they said, okay, what we're interested in is whether you can help teachers engage with research, which I think I've done. The findings of the randomized control trial are, does helping teachers engage with research after 2 years improve teaching and learning in English and maths? Maybe, maybe not, but I didn't really focus on English and maths. I focused on whatever the teachers wanted to engage with research on. So we shall see. If it does, you know, fantastic, and every school in England will be doing this. If not, then, you know, we'll see. But what we did for schools themselves was we helped them measure their own impact. And as I said before, what we would do was we would start with this process of saying, okay, let's look forward. How will things be different for your pupils if your approaches are successful? What will pupils be feeling, saying, responding, achieving? What will they be doing? And then working backwards and saying, how are they now, and how are we going to make a difference? So we engaged them in this process of continually measuring whether things were changing. But I also engaged in a little case study work with some schools in Hampshire. And I looked at their own data for how they were doing. I looked at a research use survey, and I did some paired discussions. Now, the kind of research use survey was, you know, it's not Vidalsky scale. It's a standard scale for this, and it ranges from, did you engage with the research? Was it well communicated? Did you understand it? Did you discuss the findings with others? You know, could you make reference to it? Did you use it? And so on. And it was only 13 respondents, but you know, as you can see, after going through the research learning community process, most felt that actually we'd engaged them in research in a way that they could start to use it and start to help them make different decisions. But by itself, you know, that's not powerfully strong evidence, but it's a useful yardstick for action. Then I conducted some interviews with them about, you know, the kind of chain of process they went through, and in particular, what were the activities they engaged in and why did they engage in them, and what were the outcomes in terms of the learning of teachers they'd hoped to achieve, the changes in behavior of teachers they hoped to achieve, the changes in pupils' outcomes they'd hoped to achieve. And actually, six paired discussion interviews suggested that we were making a difference to teaching and learning. So, for example, one of the primary schools we engaged with, number four, was about they wanted to change teachers' understanding of the characteristics of learning in order to impact on summer-born children. So summer-born children are those that are born later in the year, and they're basically a year behind the others in terms of their kind of development. And so they typically have lower outcomes than others. And actually they said, well, yeah, so what we're seeing as a result of this process, as a result of us engaging in the research of starting to embed new ways of learning, are that we're changing what's driving learning for these summer-born children, that teachers are more actively looking for effective learning behaviors, that actually there was a kind of more general focus on getting children to use the language of learning so it reflected the learning in their school. So they thought there was a move away from kind of curricular-specific foci to learning-specific foci. In another primary school, they started looking at pupils' mistakes and how we could use that positively. So, mistakes could be a way of developing effective learning. And they said, okay, yeah, teachers are now evidencing children's mistakes and they're playing them back to them as a way of helping them move forward. And they found that teachers were praising effort and perseverance rather than kind of just saying, no, that's right, that's wrong. And that they were sharing their experiences so that they could use this mistake typology in order to characterize what a good mistake was and what are the mistakes that and the mistakes that could be learned from and what were the mistakes that need to be reduced. Participants from three of the schools could provide detail on emerging student impacts. So with one school, they said, okay, at the beginning of the project, we talked to a group of children and we asked them to complete a problem-solving task. There were no open or probing questions. But now the children were demonstrating understanding as a result of going through the process of questioning, using questioning themselves, reflecting on, and they're assessing, you know, assessing their own learning. In terms of the mistake group, the children were using the mistake typology, And they were starting to evidence and understand their own mistakes and how they could benefit from them, and also how they could do better and take on more challenging tasks. So if you look here, it says the children are understanding in more depth how mistakes are part of the learning journey and how they can be more confident in using mistakes. And then finally, the Summerborn Children Project, they reported, and again, you teach these, take these things with a pinch of salt, but they reported a 26% increase in their student outcomes as a result of going through this process, because teachers were focusing in a different way, understanding these children in and the need to look at learning rather than curricula, which just wasn't appropriate for how those children work. So there we go. Thank you very much.
I was supposed to launch question phase with one question, so I have one. My question is about what kind of concrete change in practical organization time, schedules in these schools can you describe? What kind of practical change has made the school leaders to make possible all what is all the process from a concrete point of view? Large, big one, or small one, it's for me a big concern.
Thank you. So I think that's absolutely right. And one of the reasons we... you want me to stand up? Oh, no, I don't mind. I mean, yeah. I can sit down. Okay, perfect. No, I don't want to, I don't need to lie down.
In the mind, it's okay.
Okay, fine. So... one of the reasons we had the school leaders in the room, let's say, was exactly so that they knew what was required when they went back to school, so that they knew that they needed to do certain things to make sure that the kind of the research practices they were developing were being embedded. In some of the schools, this was more successful than others. So in the schools where they did well, they started to bring together time for people to collaborate. They started to adjust the timetables so that teachers could come together at certain times and trial and develop and talk and refine and so on. In other situations, that didn't work as well, and they kind of kept the group as a very separate group from the rest of the school. Also, sometimes with schools had accountability. The inspector was coming. Kind of everything got dropped, and they focused just on that. But I think where the school leaders did make a difference, they recognized that actually we're talking about a culture change where teachers need to collaborate, where they need to have access to research, where they need to have time to come together, where they need to have time to trial and refine, where there needed to be a trust element, where we might make mistakes, but that's okay, we're learning from those mistakes. And so so in the best schools, that's what happened. They got the kind of culture shift and the structure shift that they needed to make happen.
I have a question with the brokers and brokerage. But
So I have two questions from Joost Tolboom, who is a CIDRE coordinator for the Netherlands. And he wanted to attend, but he couldn't. So he sent me those questions. He's a mathematics and informatics curriculum developer. And he asked that how can we make teachers play an active role in research communities? First questions. And the second one was, how can we let teachers inform the research practice, for example, on the relevance of research themes? And he asked those questions because he organizes every year a conference about in the Netherlands called Education Meets Research.
Okay, good question. So the first one, I think, goes back to leadership. And actually, teachers may be willing, but it's school leaders that are going to enable it to happen within schools. Otherwise, what we need is a is a kind of cultural shift and a new way of working, of teachers developing processes and mindsets in which they want to actively seek out new ways of tackling problems of teaching and learning. And if they're not supported through head teachers, then I don't think that's going to happen. Now that's one aspect. Clearly teachers need capacity and they need skills to do that. They need to be able to access research. They need to be able to understand it and engage with it. But I think, you know, all of that comes from the leader. I also think partnerships are key, university research partnerships. I think the idea with this project is that, you know, once we'd finished, schools could do it themselves. And I think some schools will, but I think many schools valued working with the university. They valued the kind of work we were doing with them to bring concepts to life, to help them think, to structure their thinking. And I think one issue with the kind of notion of school self-improvement is that we've almost kind of left it to schools just to get on with it by themselves without building their capacity to do that. The second question, well, in England, we used to have, certainly lots of panels where teachers were trying to influence the kind of broader research themes that were going on. And you do have notions such as design-based, you know, research, which I think are key. For me, the importance is partnership again. You know, it's about, you know, clearly universities are going to have ideas for what they think needs to be researched, but teachers are going to have problems, and we need to work together to make sure that we're understanding teachers' problems and coming up with ways of helping them develop solutions. But I also think what's key is that what we're talking about here is a lamppost, not a signpost, right? We're illuminating things for teachers, not telling them what to do, and I think that partnership element is key.
Hi, thank you for a very nice and interesting presentation. I'm from Denmark, an educational researcher from Denmark, and we have, I think, some of the same, you know, questions or tendencies with the research-based movement in Denmark. And I would like to get back to some of the more maybe foundational or fundamental questions that are also normative about what constitutes actually good education. And I think one of the things that have happened internationally and also in Denmark is that the research or the evidence-based movement is very often linked to a specific notion of what constitutes good education in a good school. And you also referred to those educational systems that are high performing on PISA scores. And I think that one of the things that has happened is that the evidence movement is very often linked with the PISA tradition, and you're also very often referring to, you know, the importance of PISA and PISA scores, and you're pretty much linking good school systems with high performance PISA systems. And I think one of the risks is that it might be based on a bit narrow vision or version of what constitutes a good school system. So I think, well, at least in Denmark, we have a quite polarized discussion about, you know, evidence and PISA on one side, and then a more, traditional, maybe German, not as, you know, curriculum-based educational tradition. And we often seen quite... there are some quite strong clashes between these two traditions. And I think one of the questions for many teachers is that the evidence-based movement is hard for them to associate with, because it's often, very often, you know, linked to the PISA tradition or PISA scores, and they have a hard time, you know, relating to that tradition or that movement. I don't know, maybe it's... I'm not sure whether I'm asking you a question. It's more maybe a bit diffuse comment, but still, I think we see this polarization that is very, at least in Denmark, very strong.
It's a good point. I think, you know, in many ways, this is supposed to be, as much as it can be, I've gone the wrong way, an emancipatory approach for schools. Because when we say to them, sir, I could have done this better. Oh, when we're saying to them, what difference do you want to make? We're not necessarily specifying that needs to be in terms of, you know, pupil outcomes as measured by standard tests. And in many situations, teachers didn't come up with that as a response that they wanted. And you could see, you know, that the kind of care for their students that was coming out in terms of some of the responses, it was more about actually how we can develop pupils as rounded, you know, pupils, how we can have those as the center of what we're doing. And I've recently just finished one of these, you know, with a group of autistic teachers, for example, the teachers of autistic children, for example. And, you know, for them, it was, some of these steps were very small but important steps for their pupils, for their children. So I think when we say this to teachers, we don't mention, you know, standardized outcomes at all. We want to give them the structures to use research to improve what they do. But the end game of what that improvement looks like is for them to decide. I think, yes, you're right, it can totally be hijacked by the kind of, you know, the PISA, the kind of people who are following the PISA movement. And there is the danger of that. But I think with this vehicle, you know, it's up to the teachers to decide how they want to engage in that way.
Can I just comment shortly? Because I agree there's no necessary link between evidence-based research and then the outcome, you know, orientation in education. But I think from at least a Danish perspective, and I also think from a more international one, these two tendencies often get linked. And that, well, I think it just creates some interesting, you know, discussions.
I think also in terms of the type of research that then teachers then start to engage with, and you're right in terms of the stuff, some of the stuff we were giving them, yeah, absolutely, it was more positivistic, metasynthesis type research. If you use this, this should make the difference. That, you know, in many ways that was a pragmatic choice because we wanted them to feel able to defend themselves if, you know, school accountabilities come in. But, you know, clearly they could engage with other, you know, kind of less positivistic research, absolutely.
Well, I've got a question that is related to that question. I've heard that you said that we need a culture of trust. Yesterday I was reading the work that François Taïdein made, and it's the first word on the report. It's the necessary of this culture of trust. And can you be a bit more specific? You kind of already answered, but how can we create or promote this culture of trust?
So one of the things, I haven't got these findings here, but when we used our social network analysis, what we did afterwards, we did some regressions and modeling, and we looked at, in the schools that were more likely to engage with research, what were the factors that were driving that? And of those, and this isn't the direct answer to your question, which I will come on to, but of those, the first thing was trust was three times more powerful than anything else of those drivers. You know, whether or not they had a learning community in place, whether or not other factors were in place. So trust, you know, trust came out three times more important. I think in terms of how you facilitate that, that's a really interesting question. And I've been working with a small group of schools in the south of England to do that. And it does go back to leadership going first, I think, and for leaders to actually model and showcase the behaviors that they want. And if they're the first people to say, look, I'm opening up my classroom to you, I want to teach something differently, I want you to comment on what you've seen, engage with me and help me get better. And by doing that a little bit first, I think that starts to get the process going. I also think that, you know, you need to set up rules or protocols or whatever else. You know, if you're going to help people kind of critique and improve, what is good practice, and show good practice in that. And again, research kind of partnerships can help with that. So we can take people through processes of lesson study, and we can moderate or act as the referee as to, you know, what makes good feedback and what doesn't make good feedback. But I think someone has to go first, and if it's the leader, then at least they're putting themselves out for, you know, exposing themselves, and I think that's important.
question for us in France, who have the network, the LIAS network working, and a new organization which is called ICE, with the same interest and same concern to develop research useful for the education system. But one of our shared concern is about brokerage and those people who make change possible can change, emerge from the school itself, from a leader inside, from a natural process of development, or do you need in your organization some people who are able to launch or to accompany this movement, a kind of brokers? What kind of brokers do you use, researchers, specialists, teachers, or school heads, I don't know, people? Teacher, educators, or any, who are the people who can who can be the catalyst you are talking about? And it's a very important problem. It's a problem, natural emergence, or is it a real job to be identified and with an education behind and so on? So this is a very, we call it in French pasteur, or we're trying to find a word for it. It's not pedagogic counselors and kind of word, a new word for a new job, or for a new mission, or maybe for a new form of action. This is one of our concern. How can you find it? Because it looks so simple that just read research and discuss and everything is okay. This guy, maybe it's at schools, but this is a question for you.
Well, I think it isn't. I think it isn't simple. I mean, I think, you know, developing the materials for this process, you know, took me a good 6 months. I mean, it's not an easy. Going back to the comment about teacher educators, yeah, absolutely. I think you do need to instill this kind of notion right from the very beginning. But I don't, you know, I think it's tricky because you want it to be part and parcel of people's professional identity and what they do. And really, for me, this was about helping build capacity to do that. But the brokers in this case were both my team, but they were also the people who attended the workshops.
Researchers in your team.
Yes, yeah. Because so the brokerage worked in a number of ways. First of all, we took and we made evidence accessible. Then we worked with the teachers to engage with that evidence. But then we worked with them to show them how they could then take that evidence and take it back into their school, because we worked at a network level and we tried to create them to be brokers back in their school. But I think the key thing is understanding what the skills are required and then helping teachers and others develop those skills. So, you know, we say collaborate, but sometimes people don't know how to effectively collaborate. So you have to help them and showcase, you know, what that means. And that's part of what we were trying to do. And I also think that, not wanting to keep going back to leadership, but it, you know, in many ways, leaders are the ones that make things happen in schools. So you have to convince them, but you also have to show them, you know, give them case studies or show them how things need to be different if it's going to succeed. Because, you know, in some cases, I had dropout because school leaders were saying, well, you're not just telling me what to do. You know, I want the answers and to go back into schools. And the right people in the room for us were the ones that got that they had to engage with the research. They then had to support the kind of opinion former in embedding what was going on, that they had to get people on board, that they had to get people working together. So I think, in a sense, ideally for me, the brokers are the people within the schools, but they need help from us, or they needed help from us to get that working.
It isn't really a question, it's a comment. Chris, in one of your articles, or perhaps two of your articles, you state that unless the inspectorate in England prioritizes this, it will never really take off in all schools. And I think that's tells us something about the culture, the importance of culture, that in England it's very top-down, so the inspectorate is very powerful. So if the inspectorate were to say, tomorrow we want to see all children dressed in green, then every child in England would be dressed in green tomorrow. Okay, but it's the importance of the culture, the importance of the structures, and Chris has commented in one of his pieces that only when the inspectorate takes evidence-based practice seriously will it really take off in England. Is true for England, but probably not for all countries.
My only worry with that, I'm not saying I didn't say it. My only worry is that if they do say it and then people do react, whether the extent to which it's a depth and meaningful engagement or whether it's a tick box exercise, so I always do worry about that. But
tu regardes l'heure, Marie, tu surveilles l'heure. Hein? Bon. Non, mais c'est, on va continuer. C'est juste. Comme je more questions, maybe? Surely?
I was very impressed by your way of doing them when you identify the leaders, the most influential teachers, leaders and so on. You told us that you took an investigation with questions about who is the more relevant teacher, the advice and so on, and they really ask, okay, I ask John when I want to improve my practice, or I ask Linda when I want to understand something, and they really do that. Yeah. No problem to investigate, and that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I wish I'd brought some kind of, you develop maps of the school as a result, and I wish I'd brought some along, and I've got some on my laptop, but it's incredible, actually, the differences in schools that you can see and how connected they are. And going back to the point about trust, because you're looking at the kind of interconnectivity of people and also the strength and the depth of the relationships. And in some schools, it's a very dense, connected school, and they've got high levels of trust and they've got high levels of mutual support. And in others, you've got people who never talk to each other, and you know the kind of average trust rating is down. So it's very interesting kind of graphically to look at what's going on. And it seems, you know, it's a kind of, I believe it to be a pretty true representation of what's happening in the school. Certainly the people we then identified and said, okay, well, these are the people that are most connected. When we spoke to the head teacher, you know, sometimes they'd go, yeah, I might have guessed that actually because this person does this, they engage in this. So, it seemed to have face validity anyway. So.
Very interesting because it's a formal leadership and we all leadership, and I've never heard of that in France, to identify, to mapping the collective leadership in a school, and there is a tool to create. Yeah.
We found it in a psychosociological approach of the functioning of school or classroom and so on, informal leadership. But the problem is, we talked about where is the thing you have, the button you have to push. The simplest you can find to change things. Last question, I think it's the last question about it makes me think a lot of organization like lesson studies, change labs, and these kind of systems in other countries. Do you work on these comparative issues in order to identify or to exchange with researchers in Finland or even in Eastern countries, Far East, and so on? There's a lot of international experimentations in these fields and this kind. And do you share experience and knowledge? And with you have just a little a slide on lesson studies in your circle schema. It was my last question.
For sure. I mean, in the last 2 weeks, I mean, I've been having conversations with teachers from Singapore, from teachers from Sweden. So yeah, absolutely, we share. I've just actually relatively recently launched a research centre where it's a pipeline, basically. One end is theory, the other end is kind of practice. And what's important for me is that we do keep looking at what different people are doing and why they're doing it, but also, you know, other theories. You know, can we use semiotics, or can we use other things to actually understand how we might better engage teachers with research? So I'm trying to, yeah, I reach out to everybody and anybody to understand what they're doing, with the view that I then want to create practical solutions at the other end to use that to help teachers. So yeah, wherever possible, we look to other people to see what's happening.
Are you looking to my clock? Marie, is my clock. So, is it time for? So, if you have no more questions, but I think you. Thank you very much, Chris, for your presentation. And